Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Thanks once again for tuning in to GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast. And this week we are joined by Kelly McNamara, who is a senior research and policy analyst in Friends of the Earth U.S. Agriculture and Climate Finance Program. Now, her work involves collaborating with teams across Friends of the Earth and broader coalitions of NGOs from the Global North and the Global South to engage multilateral development banks and private sector financiers on their investments in industrial animal agriculture. Now, prior to joining Friends of the Earth, Kelly worked as a business researcher and writer at Harvard Business School and EY, and is a senior advisor and research fellow at industrial animal agricultural focused NGOs, including the Humane League, Pivot Food Investment. Now, Kelly holds a BA in philosophy from the University of Pennsylvania and an MPhil in philosophy from Cambridge University. And here she is today to talk to us about some of the climate impacts and some of the other impacts that are coming out of industrial farming globally. So hi, Kelly, welcome to GDP.
Thanks so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, great to have you. And, you know, it's a great topic. I like food. It's all I eat. But some of it is a bit harmful for the climate, from what I understand. So could you give us a sense about climate impacts that come out of industrial farming globally?
Sure. So I'll say that my focus is on industrial animal agriculture, but industrial animal agriculture occupies most of the industrial agriculture space. So when we, and just to be clear for your listeners, when we talk about industrial animal agriculture, we're not talking about smallholder farmers or nomadic herders or hobbyist chicken farmers. We're talking about multinational conglomerates. And so you might have heard the term factory farming. So we use the terms industrial livestock production and factory farming interchangeably. And these terms refer to animal breeding, rearing, slaughtering, processing, and or feed operations that are involved in the mass production of meat, eggs, and dairy. And again, these are typically controlled by multinational corporations. And the production involves breeding and rearing hundreds or thousands of animals in what are called concentrated feeding operations, or CAFOs. Mostly this is chickens, dairy cows, and pigs that live in concentrated animal feeding operations. Beef cows live on feedlots or are raised in extensive controlled grazing systems. So just to give you an idea of what that landscape looks like. So in terms of the climate, I should also say that industrial production comprises the majority of global production. So some studies say that it comprises about 75% of meat, dairy, and egg production globally. In the United States, that figure is about 99%. So climate impacts of industrial livestock production, which again encompasses feed production, which is massive. Animals and factory farming operations consume approximately 80% of the world's soy, about 75% of other cereals. These feed operations are huge, and this goes to their climate impacts. So let me break down the climate impacts for you and your listeners. So globally, the entire food system accounts for about a third of all GHG emissions. And while estimates vary, industrial livestock production accounts for about half of that, or about 15% of global GHGs. So this is more than all forms of transportation combined. So scientists have estimated that even if we immediately halted fossil fuel emissions, livestock emissions could still make it impossible to limit warming to 1.5 degrees or well below 2.2 degrees Celsius as the Paris Agreement requires. So it's important to note that these emissions arise out of killing roughly 80 billion land animals each year for food. This is huge, huge numbers of animals. And so what are the sources of GHG emissions? Well, one is from enteric fermentation from the animals themselves. So most of this is cows. Sometimes you hear folks in Congress talking about methane's a problem from cow belching, things like this. It's true. A lot of enteric fermentation is primarily from cows, also from pigs. Enteric fermentation is a problem because it's mostly methane. And as I'm sure you're aware, methane is a particularly problematic greenhouse gas because it warms the atmosphere at 80 times the rate of carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. So enteric fermentation is a big problem. A second source is also methane intensive, is manure management systems. So again, you've got hundreds or thousands or even hundreds of thousands in the case of chickens, animals crammed into warehouses, and their waste doesn't have anywhere to go. It's stored in pits and lagoons. And these pits and lagoons are huge emitters of methane. Unlike small operations where animals can roam and deposit waste in ways and at levels that land can absorb, again, factory farms have to have these massive storage facilities for manure that end up being massive sources of methane. And a third major source of GHG emissions, as I've mentioned, is feed production. So we're talking about the industrial monocropping of soy, corn, cereals for non-grazing animals. So that's chickens, pigs, cows, and beef cows on feedlots. The emissions come from the fossil fuel intensive production of synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. And also, of course, from deforestation and other forms of land use change. So converting land for cattle grazing and feed production is a leading cause of deforestation worldwide and the single largest driver of land conversion in Latin America, including in Amazon and the Cerrado. So those are the three major sources of GHG emissions. And let me pause there for a moment and see if you have any questions for me so far.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much going on with this, but it's the sheer volume that I'm trying to put into perspective here about, animal belching actually producing this kind of a methane output. That's enormous. There's some expressions about, things in the wind, but I guess it really does matter when it comes to this. Like, where are these animals? Is it just North America, or are we seeing it Europe, Asia as well, or other countries that are really investing in this method of agriculture production?
That's a great question. So first of all, you're right that the enteric fermentation is a huge problem. And again, mostly this is from cows. And unfortunately, there are not any proven methods to effectively reduce this. And particularly as we're looking toward the increase in meat and dairy production, we're talking about more animals, more enteric fermentation, and some feed additives and masks that are supposed to help the problem, really not going to help the problem. So it's a big issue.
Masks,
to
your question, like masks for cows?
Masks. Literal masks for cows. I am not kidding. I as ridiculous as that sounds, the answer is yes. The company is called Zelp. If anyone's interested in checking it out, this is a real thing. By the way, there are billions of cows in the world. And you asked me where these operations mostly exist. They're everywhere. So it originated in North America and in Europe. This is factory farming only goes back several decades. It's not that old an industry, interestingly enough. But once it had taken hold there and become more globally focused, so sourcing feed from other areas, exporting meat and dairy to developing countries that are increasing in income. Now we start to have global supply chains, and now we have global operations. So the multilateral development banks that we engage, for example, are investing in operations in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, and also in Eastern Europe. And at the same time, operations continue to proliferate across the global north. So in Canada and the US and the EU.
Wow. Okay. We got the greenhouse gases. We've got the environmental concerns here. Are there other things that we should be conscious of here? I'm thinking, the last pandemic was sort of attributed to animals in this way. And there seems to be a lot of veterinarian attention on antivirals within these feedlots. Is that something to be concerned of?
That's a great question. So factory farms are the most likely source of the next pandemic. And that is a massive problem. Again, just think about the scale. You're talking about 80 billion animals crammed into dirty, inhumane, and stressful conditions. And living in these conditions makes factory farm animals prone to inhibited immune responses and creates a perfect breeding ground for vector-borne infectious diseases, including those with zoonotic potential. So right now, as we're speaking, a strain of the highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, is spreading across industrial poultry operations in Asia, Latin America, and North America, resulting in the deaths of millions of birds and causing human illness and death, as well as economic and environmental damage. And about these animal outbreaks, the World Health Organization has warned that the variety of zoonotic influenza viruses that have led to human infections is worrying and demands increased surveillance both in animal and human populations, as well as a comprehensive examination of each zoonotic infection and planning for pandemics. So that's from the World Health Organization raising the flag. Now, I want to say also the intersection with climate is important here, because climate change will increase the prevalence and spread of diseases common among factory farmed animals, and heat-related metabolic and immune disorders among animals will intensify their susceptibility. And this is also, you raise the issue of antibiotics. So there's already a problematic reliance on antibiotics in factory farmed operations. And you might have heard about NGOs and even investors engaging with meat and dairy companies and restaurant chains, calling for commitments to eliminate antibiotics from their supply chains. And the reason is that the current levels of antibiotic use in these operations is already driving the crisis of antibiotic resistance. Again, the World Health Organization has already called this out, calling antimicrobial resistance or antibiotic resistance one of the biggest threats to global health, food security, and development today. And that's because having too many antibiotics in meat that people consume in waterways that is polluted by factory farming operations that gets into human systems makes those antibiotics less effective when those humans are actually infected by diseases that those antibiotics used to effectively combat.
Yeah. And I know there's you know, all sorts of issues with how those antibiotics get dispelled from the animals and if they wind up in water systems and how that can lead to grow. Oh, man. Yeah. So, okay. You convinced me. I'm reaching for the salad now, putting the burger down. And now, but what about some of the big development actors in this? I'm thinking about the World Bank. They've got new statements out about the climate crisis, and does industrial animal agriculture fit into their vision in any way?
That's a great question. So climate fits into the World Bank's long-term strategy. And as you've rightly pointed out, climate change is now rising to the top of the World Bank. The last president, David Malpass, made a silly comment that was not exactly climate denial, but something along those lines. And since that time, the World Bank has rebounded to double down on their commitments to align their strategies and investments and activities with the Paris Agreement. So digging a little bit for your readers here, what that means for the World Bank is that they have what they call a Paris alignment methodology. So this looks at all their activities and says, okay, is this investment, is this technical assistance project, is this other kind of development project aligned with the Paris Agreement, meaning does it contribute to GHG reductions? Does it prevent what they call carbon lock-in? So is this investment going to lock in high GHG intensive activities at the expense of allowing lower GHG activities or climate transition activities to come in? So unfortunately, in our view, the World Bank has decided that investments in industrial livestock are Paris aligned. And we have come in challenging that methodology on a couple of fronts. One, we say that reducing GHGs from agriculture, particularly from animal agriculture, is incompatible with increasing the number of animals reared and killed each year. It's incompatible with expanding the industry, which World Bank investments do, and they are doing right now. So we said there's no way that you can do that because these mitigation strategies like masks, like feed additives, are not going to resolve the GHG problem, which is huge. On the other hand, we also say that continuing to invest in factory farming infrastructure, in buildings, in water treatment plants, and even in biodigesters that are not going to effectively solve the methane problem from the manure pits and lagoons I referred to before. Continuing to invest in that kind of infrastructure is going to prevent investments in what we need, which are non-industrial, agroecological, environmentally and climate aligned systems that can effectively address food insecurity. So effectively what we need, and we're going to get to this in a moment, I think, but effectively what we need is a deindustrialization of food, is the return to the point where we can generate sufficient yields while also respecting natural resources. And this is important. It's important not just from a climate perspective. It's important from a water perspective. Industrial operations are incredibly water intensive, mostly because of feed production. Again, the World Health Organization has said, you know, the majority of the world is going to be suffering under water stress conditions by 2030. This is an incredibly salient issue. Water pollution, also a massive issue from the manure pits, from barns, from slaughterhouses. Nutrient and phosphorus pollution is a major problem of waterways globally. Right now at Friends of the Earth, we're working with indigenous communities in Ecuador that have lost their livelihoods, their drinking water, their access to hygiene of a major river because of factory farming operations located along the river that they use. It's called the Parapa. In the U.S., it's the same issue. We see the Delmarva region, algal blooms in waterways. This is diminishing the use of that water and making people sick. So again, we've got other environmental issues aside from climate. So when we engage the World Bank, we say, look, this is incompatible with a 1.5 aligned future. It's incompatible with a sustainable use of natural resources, both from a climate and a biodiversity and a sustainability perspective. And it's not good for food security. I mean, the reality is that factory farming is incredibly inefficient. Only a fraction of the calories that enter the system and enter into animals actually comes out of the system in terms of edible food. So in terms of calories and protein for human consumption. So just so your listeners know, that's what Friends of the Earth is doing right now, engaging with the banks and saying, wait. You've claimed Paris alignment, you've claimed SDG alignment, and we're here to say that expanding this industry is incompatible with both.
Well, right on. So I guess my last question then is, if the bank and if other big drivers of this industry were to say, okay, yeah, we hear you, they usually in the second breath want to hear alternatives that are ready to go. So do we have a few of those that we can refer to?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right. They are, they're asking us, okay, so if not this, then what? And I would say there are two sides to the solution piece. One is on the demand side. I mean, this is just a fact. The overconsumption of animal products has to end. Where it can end, it must. I know the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN Environment Program, and climate experts all agree that where possible, global dietary shifts away from animal products and toward plant-forward diets must take place. And this is not universally in the global north. It's also in places where development banks are currently expanding factory farming. And the development banks have admitted this themselves. The Inter-American Development Bank has released two reports in recent years explaining both the need to reduce meat consumption in Latin America for reasons pertaining to climate and environmental preservation more generally, as well as the economic benefits of a shift to plant-forward agricultural systems. So that's an important piece. And food waste must also end. It's important for your listeners to understand a third of all food globally is wasted. That includes animal products. So that's a major issue that needs to be addressed on the consumer side. The overconsumption of animal products has also contributed to public health crises, increasing diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic or fatal diseases, and food insecurity. Well, again, 800 million people, or a tenth of the world's population, is hungry, while the majority are overconsuming. So it's important to keep the demand shifts in mind. And development banks do influence policy. They influence government. They influence subsidies. What are we subsidizing? Are we subsidizing overconsumption of the wrong things? Are we subsidizing the underpricing of the wrong foods? Are we subsidizing waste? So we've got to think about those pieces. In terms of the systems, we're looking for, and what we say to multilateral development banks, is that where livestock production can improve nutrition and food security and livelihoods, the banks should, in consultation with local communities, support diversified, agroecological, mixed crop, livestock, and plant-based systems that deliver climate and biodiversity-related benefits, and also support small-scale farmers who are the backbone of community food sovereignty and security. So agroecological production systems that support sustainable numbers of animals, that's very important, sustainable numbers of animals, and that can reduce agricultural fossil fuel dependency, GHG emissions, and build healthy soils that conserve water, enhance carbon sequestration, and improve farmers' resilience to floods and droughts. So this is not necessarily the most industry-friendly system, right? We're asking for, at some measure, of deindustrialization of the system and a return to food systems that respect resources and that can deliver what we need in terms of nutrition and sufficient calories and proteins to begin feeding people who are hungry right now and suffering, not because we don't have enough food, but because we don't have the right kind of food and we don't have the right distribution systems.
Well, I think those are all fair points, Kelly. And I do hope that these conversations can continue to unfold with the work that you're doing with Friends of the Earth. And, you know, thank you so much for giving us such a deep dive into just how serious these impacts are within the industrial animal agricultural system. It's quite revealing. And I think once you also underscore the role of waste in the system, that might just be the baseline to get people thinking about, ooh, are we just producing for the sake of producing? Or maybe we've got to just tie this up a bit better and again, find those methods that are going to be more in line with a climate conscious 21st century. But yes, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us on GDP.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.